I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As NATO meets about sending more international troops to support the United States in Afghanistan, some American troops are on their way there. An Army Reserve Combat Stress Unit left for Afghanistan today. It's the same unit that lost a quarter of its members in last month's Fort Hood shooting rampage. The 467th Medical Detachment Unit provides counseling to soldiers. Its members were at Fort Hood for just one day when Major Nadal Hassan allegedly opened fire. Among the 13 people killed were three of the unit's members. Six others were hurt. 23-year-old Army Specialist Grant Moxon was among those injured. He's now home in Wisconsin recovering from a gunshot wound to the leg. And Grant, what are your thoughts as your unit heads to Afghanistan today?
You know, I have to say it's definitely a bittersweet moment. I was, you know, really looking forward to this originally, and now I can't be a part of that. You know, looking back on it, it's kind of hard to take.
Some people might say, why would you look forward to this, Grant?
It goes back to the original reason why I joined the Army. You know, I joined to help people. And, you know, I was looking forward to going over there and being able to help the soldiers over there that need mental health work and counseling. And, you know, now I can't use those talents.
It's my understanding that the members of the unit who left for Afghanistan early today were wearing black bracelets etched with the names of five killed soldiers, three from their unit, two from another combat stress unit. How difficult do you think it's going to be for them to help troubled soldiers when they've just been through this?
It might take a little while, but from what I've seen, you know, after all we've been through, you know, I got to spend a little while with them before I was sent back home. And they're definitely pulling through really well. You know, we've had a lot of support from, you know, the Army in general, and then this is what we do for a living. It may take a little while for them to get back in the swing of things, but it definitely makes them more effective counselors in the long run.
So they're almost better equipped to be able to do this now.
Very much so.
Remind us of what happened to you at Fort Hood.
It started out like any other day. We're sitting there doing some paperwork for pre-deployment, getting ready to leave, and then, you know, I was sitting there playing solitaire on my cell phone, and all of a sudden I hear somebody yelling something. It was just chaos. I mean, people, there was yelling, screaming, people just trying to get out of the way. I mean, I don't think anybody really knew what was going on for probably a couple minutes after that.
How did you survive?
I got lucky. I got very lucky. You know, I don't know how I survived and why others didn't, but, you know, when I got shot, I just hit the ground, you know. Yeah, your training kicks in. You know, everything that the Army's pounded into my head over the years. You know, you hear gunshots, you hit the deck. That's the first thing you do, and then you go and pull yourself behind cover. So I dragged myself behind a desk, and, you know, that could quite possibly be what saved me.
How are you doing now?
Doing good now, actually. Up and walking, no longer using a cane or crutches, so prognosis looks pretty good, and it might be a little while before I can start running again, though, so.
Major Nadal Hassan, who's accused in the Fort Hood shooting, is now undergoing psychiatric evaluations. He was actually supposed to go with your unit to Afghanistan. What do you think of the way this case is being handled?
I think they're handling it pretty well. You know, it's too bad that a guy in his position had to do what he did, especially, you know, considering he was a psychiatrist and we're mental health. But, you know, from what I've seen, the investigation is being handled very professionally, and, you know, justice will be served.
Will you keep in touch with the members of your unit while they're over there?
Oh, definitely. I'll be back here doing paperwork, but definitely, you know, we'll be able to Skype now and then help them out if they need anything, you know, logistics-wise or just somebody to talk to.
So far, what do they say about going over there? Do they feel a little bit anxious about it?
I think they're, a few of them are a little anxious, but the general consensus seems that, you know, everybody's kind of finally ready just to get out of here and, you know, finish this up and finally get over there and start doing what we've been training for the last few months.
You have a degree in psychology, right, from the University of Wisconsin.
Yep.
What are you going to do now?
Well, right now I'm going to heal up. And then once I'm done with that, I've been considering going to officer school and maybe going on to get my master's degree.
Going to officer school?
Yep.
So you continue to work in the military?
Oh, definitely. I like it. You know, despite everything that happened, it's still a good job, and I love the people. Mm.
And because of the shooting, you actually have a bullet in your leg, and it's going to stay there.
Yep. A lifelong reminder. The doctors decided that if they were to dig it out, it would cause more problems right now. There's an emotional part there, but, you know, it'll take a while to get over.
Well, 23-year-old Army Specialist Grant Moxon was injured in the Fort Hood shooting last month. He's recovering from a gunshot wound to the leg, and the rest of his unit, the 467th Medical Detachment, was deployed to Afghanistan today. Grant, thanks very much for being with us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, too.
When Harold Evans was editor of the Times of London, his father told him, "What would people say if they knew the man editing this newspaper is the grandson of a man who could not read a word of it?" Well, that gives you a pretty good snapshot of the remarkable life of Harold Evans. His father was a railroad engineer, his mother a shopkeeper. He was born in Manchester, England in 1928, and he did nothing less than go on to revolutionize British journalism. As editor of the Sunday Times, he filled the paper's pages with investigative reporting that exposed such things as Britain's treatment of the so-called thalidomide children and the betrayals of the Soviet spy Kim Philby. In 2004, he was knighted for his contributions to journalism. Today, at the age of 81, he's part of a publishing power couple. He's married to Tina Brown, editor of the website The Daily Beast. His new memoir is My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times, and Sir Harold Evans joins us in the studio to talk about this. Welcome.
Thanks, Deborah.
You begin your book with a scene on the beach in Wales in 1940. You're on holiday with your family at the time, and you see soldiers on the beach. They're British soldiers who were evacuated from Dunkirk. Why did you start with that story?
It was an epiphany for me. I'd been reading newspapers. I was only 12, and we were living through wartime bombing, and my father was driving munitions trains. So it was very exceptional to go on a holiday for a start. But secondly, when my father talked to them, squatting there and giving them a cigarette, and he was only 39, my father, he learned that the ordeals they'd gone through, the lack of proper equipment, the betrayal, as they saw it, by the French and by the service I later joined, the Royal Air Force, and they did not want to go back. They'd been very badly equipped, etc., etc., and the many heroes, of course, who helped to get them escape. And so when my father got back with me to the hotel, the boarding house, nobody knew that there were Dunkirk survivors, just arrived. And he started telling them what the men had said, and it was such a contrast with the headlines pinned up in the boarding house, "Bloody marvellous victory, men wait, can't wait to go back." And it was such a lie. Now, I understood possibly why the newspaper did it, to restore morale and so on and so on, and also, you know, a national sense of purpose. And I understood that, even at the age of 12, but it made me think, now, where did that newspaper get its facts from? How many soldiers did they interview? Was it right to put a gloss on the experiences that were so terrible? And in fact, that made me think, I'd already interested in newspapers, because I was reading the Rupert the Bear cartoons, I was reading Beachcomber, the totally hilarious, surreal column in the Daily Express. But it was the same Daily Express that had a big headline every day through the 30s saying, "There will be no war, there will be no war, there will be no war." And so I thought, how can I possibly equip myself as a kid of 12 in a working class background? I can possibly equip myself to enter this amazing, thrilling mosaic of gathering and presenting news honestly and truthfully. And that was an epiphany. I know it sounds kind of earnest, but it's true. That made me determined that for the rest of my life, I would try and present the news truthfully and honestly.
So do you think it was your calling, journalism?
Yes, it was. It became a calling. It makes me sound as though I should be wearing vestments of some kind. But it was a lot of fun. I mean, and I hope the book, my memoir, reflects it was a huge amount of fun. But I was living through the social revolutions in England. I mean, don't forget, the English class system, which enabled only about 2% of eligible kids to get to college, for instance, and when I failed the 11 plus and couldn't go to high school, that meant I was doomed to live a manual life, which is what my father was determined I wouldn't do. So they saved up and got me a shorthand typing course, which enabled me to start on newspapers. I tried to fulfill those early ambitions all along, and I was fortunate. I had a lot of luck, because those social revolutions that I talk about enabled me to surf the waves to get to be editor of the Sunday Times and the Times. I'm still the only person who's ever edited both those famous great newspapers. I mean, for instance, what broke the English class system and the need to have an exit like this, my fair chaps, you know? What was the Goon Show? Hello, this is Peter Sellers, or whatever. So those comedy shows made you realise the absurdity of trying to talk different, you know? So, in fact,
but instead,
when we came to America, my young son horrified me at the age of five, running across the lawn saying, "It's so frightfully cold here."
And you used to listen to the BBC, and that really spoke.
But the BBC was absolutely crucial. First of all, it was a wonderful service because here is the news, and this is Alvar Liddell reading it. There was a note of authority and credibility, which was actually, even though it was saying, "We have had another disaster or sea today," even though he was saying that, it was fabulous to reassure him because it could be so trusted. And then, of course, I also listened on the radio. Radio is a fantastically important medium. Listening on the radio to "We will fight on the beaches," etc. And then Franklin Roosevelt saying, "You can be assured we will stay with Britain in these fights." And right. So both the belligerence of Churchill and the avuncular tones of Roosevelt as I was sitting in an air raid shelter being bombed made a huge difference to my approach to life.
And so you really were influenced a lot by radio, by the newspapers, and by the whole class system of where you were growing up at the time. Was that, do you think, what appealed to you about journalism was being able to uncover abuses in the system, injustices, and try to help correct them?
Yeah, I think there's a duty as an editor and a journalist also to record things straight so that other people can make up their minds. So I didn't wake up every morning saying, "What abuse can I correct today?" I woke up in the morning thinking, "Have we produced a paper which is accurate? Have we covered what's happening properly? Is the paper also amusing? Has it treated the arts properly? Is it doing decent book reviews?" All those questions were just as important to me. But when, as it were, one stumbled against a scandal like was hidden like a rock beneath the sand, I felt two obligations. One, to dig into the sand and find the rock. And secondly, if it was, in fact, a lethal rock, to do something about it. I was always thought of, I think it was King Edward who said, "If this disease is preventable, why not prevent it?"
That's Harold Evans. His memoir is called My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. You can read an excerpt at our website, hereandnow.org. We'll have more with Sir Harold after a break. And later in the show, what can the Pentagon learn from Greg Mortensen? We'll be back in a minute. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with longtime newspaper man Harold Evans. His work as a crusading editor for the Sunday Times, the Times of London, and other British newspapers earned him knighthood in 2004. He's also the husband of another media star, Tina Brown, formerly of The New Yorker and now of The Daily Beast. And now at 81, Harold Evans has written his memoir called My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. And Sir Harold, let's talk about the state of newspapers today. Do you think the type of investigative journalism that you did on the thalidomide story, for example, can still be done? Are we losing that?
We probably are, I'm sorry to say. I'll give you an example of what you lose when newspapers close, whether local or national, or when they diminish their editorial input by trying to save money by cutting the very thing which makes a newspaper valuable, the editorial. Really enrages me what's been happening in Los Angeles and Chicago. Mm. What we're going to lose is what we're living now. You are now living with the consequences of a lack of reporting. For instance, the financial meltdown. Only two or three columnists drew attention to what was happening in the housing bubble and the financial bubble. There was Paul Krugman, who got a Nobel Prize for it, Mort Zuckerman, and Gretchen Morgan in the New York Times. basically television and, if I may say so, radio and everybody else didn't report it. They didn't report what was happening. Similarly, the Iraq War. If there'd been proper reporting on the whole issue, we might have avoided that catastrophe and we might have avoided this catastrophe. So when people say to me, it was a guy at Harvard said to Harry Kurtz of the Washington Post, I don't need you, I've got YouTube. Hello? You've got YouTube. What are you going to do, film your navel? Give me a break. This idiot at Harvard, he should be in some lunatic asylum. The idea that we might be breeding a generation which has that superficial and cavalier attitude and unsophisticated attitude to what is news is productive, will be productive, of disasters. It's same in the 30s. Germany persecuting the Jews, Germany getting ready for war. Was it reported? No. Was the fact that the Germans were rearming like mad? It was underplayed. My old paper, The Times of London, edited by Geoffrey Dawson, was an appeasement newspaper, so he used to leave notes, make sure we do not print anything tonight which upsets Mr. Hitler. That's the kind of world you're going to get if this Harvard idiot, excuse me, I feel very strongly about it. YouTube is a very useful thing, but I met one of the founders and he said, you can't beat video for understanding. Excuse me, that's a ridiculous statement. The idea that we can do without the plurality of information and the creation of understanding and awareness of what's happening around us, which is what newspapers have conventionally done, with some help from other media, but mainly newspapers. Most of the things are found out by newspapers. People are going to live a life which may not be short, brutish and nasty, but it will be certainly less safe and enjoyable than it is when proper reporting is done.
It doesn't matter if we read it in a paper, when we have actual paper to open up and read, or we click and read it online and see journalism that way? Is there
no, it doesn't matter, really. The question is, and you'll have to ask every eyeball you can meet, would this eyeball prefer to have a cup of coffee and sit and open the pages of a newspaper and experience the joys of what I call serendipity, that you don't know what you want to read until it's there? I can click online and go to something like housing boom, but in the next column of the newspaper it may be something about H&M virus which my eye will catch. So there's a big advantage there. It doesn't matter. I do think some of the websites are really serving a terrific thing, and some of the opinion websites are also doing really good work. Some of the best investigative journalism has come from sites like Zombie and another one, the Daily Howler, which does a very essential role in monitoring mass media. The Daily Howler, it's hilariously funny and really positive and very, very helpful. I'd encourage everybody to go on that while not deserting the newspapers or mainstream television. So it doesn't really matter. My guess is that we will use the websites for what they're best at, which is speed, diversity and video images and range, and we will use newspapers for depth of comprehension and stuff. And when you will get newspapers, as you will print your newspaper at home. It will be collated by professional journalists who will rate the news value. You know it's going to be credible because it's got the name attached to it. You're going to have authenticity, and maybe it will have range and depth to it as well. You'll be able to print it at home. You'll look Packard are making machinery now which can facilitate that. And that can also save the press because it's much cheaper to print on demand both newspapers, books and magazines than it is to print and have on souls on your hands.
Right. But I just wonder, when you say that if you don't have the paper in front of you and you might miss the serendipity of coming across a story that you may not have otherwise read, isn't there also that danger if you rely on getting information from certain websites that filter it for you and tell you what some of the big stories are of the day? You miss that if you're relying on one website to consolidate the information for
you,
too.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think I get attacked for saying this, or rather, that's not quite the right word, derided, when so many journalists are suffering, and I certainly feel for them. I think we may be entering a golden age where we combine the best of electronic with the best of print, or rather what was normally done to serve print but may now be done to serve electronic means of delivery, whether it's printed or on a screen.
Golden age. I think there are a lot of people who would disagree with you on that one until we figure out a model to
make
it more.
Well, I go around with a label which I took off entering here saying, beware, this man is an eternal optimist. And it's contagious.
Well, Harold Evans, his book about his life and journalism is called My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. You can read an excerpt at our website. Sir Harold, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Deborah, for a stimulating conversation. There's no argument here.
Thanks very much. This note about next week on Here and Now, we'll be checking in throughout the week on the climate talks in Copenhagen. Also, we talk with author Ha Jin. His novels and short stories have focused on life back in his native China. His latest work looks at the lives of Chinese immigrants in the U.S. That's next week. Still ahead today, we get an opinion on Afghanistan and Pakistan from a man with an unusual point of view, Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen. The news is next, Here and Now. NATO's Secretary General says 7,000 more international troops will join the 30,000 additional American troops that President Obama is deploying to Afghanistan next year. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels today that the troop increase is crucial and their presence will not be indefinite. The BBC's defense correspondent Nick Childs joins us from Brussels. And Nick, what nations are sending these troops?
Well, they're not all announcing officially themselves what they're doing, so I think that's going to trickle out. But certainly sources close to the meeting are talking about, as you say, all in all, some 7,000 troops at least from at least 25 countries. What we're talking about are Italy, 1,100, Georgia, over 900, and various other countries from NATO and the non-NATO members of ISAF providing various different contributions, a lot smaller than that. One of the interesting elements to this is that there are a number of countries that are not currently members of ISAF that have pitched in with offers, like Mongolia and Montenegro and Colombia and the Republic of Korea, which will become the 44th member of ISAF, offering 400 troops.
Mm-hmm. And also, we do not know what France and Germany might do.
No, indeed. And I think there is a hope here in NATO that there will be a bit of a momentum behind this and that France and Germany will get the message. Secretary Clinton, the words she was using about today were encouraging and significant in terms of the commitment. I think people are understanding that promises have yet to be turned into effective forces. But if that process goes on, then the French and the Germans may come the London conference on Afghanistan at the end of January, think again. But for now, the French foreign minister, who was asked about this after the meeting, was pretty robust in his response. He said, look, we sent some extra troops when people weren't even talking about this. So as far as we're concerned for now, nothing. But he didn't rule out something after London at the end of January.
Do we know where these NATO troops will go in Afghanistan and what they might do, Nick?
Well, I think that's part of the key detail that's got to be worked on yet. And interestingly, although this was an important moment for NATO, and this was the foreign ministers, the sort of fairly heavy lifters for all the countries at this meeting, the actual detail is going to be worked out over the next days and weeks. There's another meeting of NATO military officials on Monday called a fourth generation meeting, and they'll be picking through all this, working out exactly what troops, what are we talking about in terms of actual troops and equipment. There is this issue out there of whether some of these troops will be sent to the riskier parts of the mission. The burden sharing argument has been out there for a long time, the Americans and the British complaining that some people aren't prepared to put their people in harm's way. Some others, I think, pushing back on that a little bit and saying, look, for us, these are big commitments. We're small countries. Slovakia, for example, is doubling its number of troops, only from 250 to about 500, but then they're only a population of about 5 million, and they have a hugely hostile population as far as this mission is concerned. So that, you know, the arguments will go on around that, but clearly turning promises into effective forces is a challenge still ahead.
Right. Just briefly, Nick, is there a sense that these extra NATO troops are a diplomatic win for President Obama, that diplomacy has achieved results for the United States, or is there a sense that the U.S. may have fallen short here?
I think it's an ongoing process, as I said. Yes, the mood is different. Yes, this is a response to President Obama. Some of it is the change in the way the Americans approach this. But there's also a sense, I think, that NATO realizes that as far as the Americans were concerned, this was the last throw. And if they don't join up now, then the Americans aren't going to come up with more troops in the future.
Okay, BBC defense correspondent Nick Childs joined us from the NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels. Nick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Greg Mortensen is up next after a quick break. It's Here and Now. Amid the debate over troop levels in Afghanistan, what can humanitarian and author Greg Mortensen teach the military? Mortensen's story is well known. His first book was Three Cups of Tea. In it, he described himself as an American mountain climber who took a wrong turn and almost died, but was saved by villagers in Pakistan. So, in return, he built a school for them. And since then, he's built more than 100 schools, most of them for girls, in some of the most remote parts of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the U.S. military has been turning to Mortensen for information about that region. His new book is titled Schools into Stones, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs, in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Greg Mortensen joins us in our studios. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah. It's nice to be here.
Well, you know, the stories in your new book are very powerful, just as the stories in your first book were, the struggles of young girls to get an education in that part of the world. And, of course, President Obama made the announcement this week that he's sending 30,000 more U.S. troops to that part of the world. What do you think?
Well, the one thing that I was concerned about is the meetings to discuss and deliberations about more troops was held in secrecy, behind closed doors. There was no testimony on Capitol Hill. Nobody was invited to speak either for or against it. It was deliberated by some generals and some people in Congress. The other thing that I was concerned about is that there was no consultation with the Shura, the elders of Afghanistan, about this. This is a decision that would impact the people, and the Shura were never consulted or invited to that. The only case where the Shura were invited were we've helped facilitate dozens of meetings between the U.S. military and the elders in Afghanistan. This is on the request of the elders. They've asked to meet with the military. And the things that they are saying is, number one, we don't need firepower, but we do need brain power. They are quite keen on the, say, National Guard and reservists, who are veterinarians, agronomists, horticulturalists, journalists, nurses, doctors, who are coming over to help. But they say we can take care of our problems ourselves. We don't need more troops over there.
Hmm. So basically, they would be opposed to this, and so would you.
Yeah, I would say we need to listen to the people more, and if they want more troops, then we could send more troops. But if they don't want more troops, then why are we making decisions about more troops there? I can also say that I think the U.S. military has gone through a huge learning curve. I have tremendous respect for the military. Many of our officers have been in Afghanistan 3 or 4 times, and I think they really get it. It's about building relationships. It's about respecting the elders and also more listening. Many senior military commanders, actually, it's required reading now for senior military commanders, Three Cups of Tea. And I visit about 24 military bases a year on my own without any compensation to help brief troops going over there. So I can say that in some ways, I think our military is ahead of the State Department in that they've been building relationships. But again, we really haven't sat down and talked to the elders. Mm. And I really think the elders are the power in Afghanistan.
I almost wonder, a lot of your work has been done in that part of the world when the U.S. military has been there, when U.S. troops have been there to help keep the peace. Can you do your work and be as successful and build more than 130 schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan without the U.S. military?
Well, we started our work in Afghanistan in 1999. We are working in some areas where there's no U.S. military presence, and I'm not talking about the peace warriors. These are areas that are quite controlled by the Taliban. And the way we're able to do that is because we have relationships with the elders. This year was actually our most successful year ever. We were able to put in the first girls' high school in five provinces in Afghanistan, including up in Nuristan province, in Oruzgan province. And one of the kind of interesting, the way we did it is some tribal elders from Oruzgan province came, visited one of our schools. They were interested in building a girls' school. And when they got there, and these are, fierce men with black turbans, and they were armed to the teeth. They got to the school, and they saw this giant playground. So they tossed down their weapons, and then for an hour and a half, they went on the swing sets and slides and played. And then I said, let's get serious, have a Jirga meeting and make a decision. They said, no, we're totally satisfied. We want a girls' high school in Tarankot, Oruzgan, but we definitely want a playground in the school. Mm-hmm. So we went back there in September. We had a huge meeting, and now they've broken ground and starting a school in that province.
Well, your daughter actually told you to build playgrounds over there, didn't she?
That was my daughter who started that.
You also, this book is a follow-up to Three Cups of Tea, and you outline the continuing struggles, whether it's tribal elders or violence and cultural differences in really the unbelievably remote parts of the world that you're doing this type of work and building these schools with playgrounds. And also, you had to deal with the 2005 earthquake. I mean, you just have had so many obstacles put up during that time. And it was after the 2005 earthquake in Pakistan that your book tells a story, a very powerful story of a very young girl there. Can you retell that story for us?
This young woman's name is Farzana. She was a ninth grader. We had trouble. We set up dozens of temporary schools in the earthquake area in Pakistan, but we couldn't get kids to come to school. And one day Farzana came up to me and said, if you put desks in the schools, the kids will come to school. And I thought it was a little bit strange because people are used to sitting on the floor and tents. They had a lot of tents there. But we salvaged some desks. We put them in the school, and lo and behold, hundreds of kids started coming to school, and we then started a massive desk campaign. But the reason the desks helped kids come back to school is that most of the kids who died in the earthquake were younger and female, but they didn't have desks. And so desks symbolized life. Many, when the walls came crashing down and the roofs collapsed, it killed mostly the kids who didn't have desks. So Farzana knew that death symbolized life. And again, I'm very fortunate that I listened to Farzana, because later on, actually, many of the big aid groups then started putting in desks in the tents, and it triggered off thousands of kids to return back to school.
Very briefly, can you describe for me how you think the feelings toward the U.S. may have changed in your time since you've been there, and in the time since the United States has sent troops to Afghanistan?
From people in Afghanistan. I think the people in the rural areas, they still see individual Americans as very good and generous people, but they also... they're fearing that we don't build relationships, we don't have human contact with them, and unless we do that, I think we'll become more disparate and separate from them. So we have to drink three cups of tea and start building relationships with the people.
We'll keep building relationships and schools. Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you, Deborah.
Greg Mortensen, his new book is Schools into Stones, Promoting Peace with Books, Not Bombs in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Television show host Ted Allen has worn many hats. He started his professional life as a journalist. He became one of the Fab Five makeover artists on the show Queer Eye. Then he moved to the Food Network, where he's the host of two shows. One is Chopped, where chefs are given mystery baskets of mismatched ingredients and have to create dishes with them in 20 to 30 minutes. Those who fail get chopped. Those who succeed get $10,000. The other show is Food Detectives, where Allen gets to the bottom of some commonly held food beliefs, like this one.
You probably have heard the claim that eating turkey makes you drowsy. You might also have heard that there's a chemical called tryptophan that has something to do with it. Think about the ramifications.
Ted Allen has also cast his critical eye as a judge on Top Chef and Iron Chef America, and he's the brand ambassador for Robert Mondavi Private Selection Wines. Just the sort of person you'd want to have at your holiday party, or maybe not. But in any case, Ted Allen joins us in the studio to talk about all things food, wine, and television. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
How do you go from journalist to food guru?
I didn't realize guru was in the title. I've been called an ambassador, but I don't have diplomatic immunity. I was just talking with a journalism student who was asking me for advice on where to go in this difficult market. And the one piece of advice I could give someone like that is that you just have to keep yourself open to all kinds of strange opportunities that your skills might lend themselves to. And that's certainly what I did when I went to audition for Queer Eye. I was a writer for Esquire magazine. I was based in Chicago, so they didn't really know what I was up to, which was fun. But my partner Barry and I were very happy. I just auditioned for this thing on a lark.
But you really evolved into, now you're really known as a foodie, a big foodie.
It is so exciting and gratifying to be able to do something that you're passionate about. And honestly, what I've really enjoyed so much about Top Chef and Iron Chef and now Chopped is that the intellectual exercise of taking two plates of food and evaluating which chef had just that much better work, or which chef made a crucial mistake or committed some grave offense against a culinary culture of one sort or another, I find that so absolutely fascinating. I could do it all day long, and lucky for me, I do.
What about when you go to a holiday party or a holiday function this time of year? People intimidated when you come around?
My mother is intimidated to cook for me, which is awful. I feel terrible. I sort of understood this feeling once when I was walking down 7th Avenue with Barry when we used to live in Manhattan. Now we live in Brooklyn. And we lived right across the street from Bobby Flay and his wife. And we ran into them on the street, and we had just renovated our kitchen. And Barry said, "Hey, Bobby, you and Stephanie should come over for dinner." And I thought, what? What are you doing inviting a famous chef to my house for dinner? I would have made chili. Seriously.
So what do you think, though? What do you tell people? They must ask you this time of year, what's a common sort of holiday party mistake that people should avoid, or a good tip that you think you might give people?
Deputize some of your family and friends to make some dishes and help you out. Mm. It always seems to be one person, always a woman, always someone, usually it's my mom, doing all the work.
You intimidate?
I jump in now. Actually, I like the idea of having a semi-potluck holiday meal. That way, other families are bringing their traditions to your table. They might make something you wouldn't have thought of, or they might make it better than you. And have a glass of wine and enjoy this meal, and don't just be a slave to the family. I mean, you're supposed to be celebrating.
Right. Speaking of wine, I've been doing this for a long time, but no one has ever brought in glasses and bottles of wine for an interview. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well, you know how they
hope my boss doesn't walk by, but it's very nice.
Well, it's excellent wine. And you know how they have a 2-drink minimum at a comedy club? Mm. It's not just because they want to make money. It's because you'll think they're funnier.
But it's very nice. So thank you for doing that. You've talked about wine pairings. You've written about wine pairings. A lot of people are intimidated by wine pairings. They're not quite sure. Can you really do red with this or white with this or whatever? Rule of thumb. What do you tell people when they're just starting out and they're trying to figure out what to do?
Think about your wine as if it were a spice that you're adding to your entree. Let's say you're having shrimp scampi, which is shrimp that you're sautéing in butter and garlic and some lemon. You're probably going to want a white wine with that because it's a seafood dish, but it does have a lot of powerful flavors in it. So you might not want something terribly light. Maybe you'd want a Chardonnay with that. Maybe because the dish has lemon in it, maybe you want a wine that has some lemony notes. And this is one of the reasons why wine experts like to talk about those constituent components in a wine. Oh, it's got notes of lipstick and tobacco and soil. I know they sound pretentious, and I'm not going to do them anymore. But that vocabulary is somewhat helpful when you're trying to match a wine to a dish.
Hmm. In the show Chopped, those are big challenges that you give to some of those professional chefs.
It's vicious, actually.
It's vicious. Do you help determine those ingredients?
No. The people who do are a particularly sadistic group of Food Network employees in the culinary department.
They're those mean people down the hall.
They seem so nice, but really, there's a streak of sadism running through these Food Network people. I love the fact that I'm the host of Chopped and that I don't have to judge, because while I do have to deliver the bad news that someone's been chopped, I'm not the one who made the decision, and I also don't have to taste the food unless it looks tasty.
You know, I can't say that we're even nearly as qualified as the folks on your show, but we thought we might have a little fun. We thought we might make a mystery basket.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So we did. It looks like almost one of the baskets on the show. It's got the lid.
Yeah.
And you can open it up and tell me what you think.
Okay. And we have chunk light tuna in water. We have cashew halves and pieces. You couldn't spring for the whole nuts. Oh, it's public radio, right. I say that with love. I do. And then we have soy milk. And this is just plain soy milk, so it's not vanilla, which is really the better tasting soy milk.
Now, you would have to start cooking right now. You'd have about 20 minutes or 30, depending on the appetizer, entree, or dessert contest that you'd be involved in. So tuna, cashew, soy milk.
If it weren't, this is a good basket. This is a tough one. Because if I just had the tuna and the cashews, then I could think about a salad. I could do some kind of a niçoise salad-ish thing that just happens to have nuts on it. It would probably taste pretty decent. I do have a pantry, right? I have lettuce.
Right.
I have lettuce.
And we don't, but you would in our little pretend contest here.
In our minds, we do. How am I going to combine soy milk and tuna?
Hmm.
That just sounds terrible. Yeah. Let's just put it all in a blender and make a smoothie.
Yuck. You know, the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. Oh, wait. What if I took the soy milk and I combined it with flour and I made a flatbread or a crepe or something? Well, then I got a tuna crepe with cashews.
Ugh. Yuck.
Let's order a pizza.
Is that an option? You'd get chopped.
Yeah, I might get chopped. I got to say, that's a tough one. I'm also not a chef.
But you do cook.
Oh, I love to cook. Yeah. I cook all the time.
You know what I think the key is the well-stocked pantry.
Absolutely.
It's really the key. And I think it's almost one of the messages of the show, that you can really be given just about anything, but if you have enough on hand, you can probably make something pretty terrific if you're creative, yes?
Wait, I've got it. I've got it.
Here's okay.
It's so obvious. I'm going to make a soy mayonnaise, and I'm going to make tuna salad sandwiches with cashews.
Very nice.
That's excellent. Oh, I'm so proud of myself. Do I get $10,000?
Well, unfortunately, it is public radio, as you said.
So you get $10.
Well, thank you for bringing in a lovely Pinot Noir. Cheers.
Cheers. I hope you enjoy it, and may you have many more drinks at work in the studio if the producers don't happen to listen to this segment.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ted Allen hosts Food Network's Food Detectives and Chopped. He's also the food and wine ambassador for Robert Mondavi Private Selection Wines. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again. Here and Now.